On the Empire podcast this week, we have a producer, a director, his wife and her lover, or we would have if we hadn't already eaten his wife and her lover. So we'll have to make do with the entirely uneaten talents of Jason Blum, the producer, and Brett Ratner, the director, as they talk The Purge Anarchy and Hercules, respectively. That's not all, though. We also cast our beady critical collective eye on the likes of, well, The Purge Anarchy and Hercules, as well as Nick Cage's latest possible return to form, Joe. Plus, all the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that's currently being beamed into your brain via hypnotic space lasers operated by half-kit and half-cat creatures known as Cattons, who invisibly float around your head on tiny clouds of smugness. No, wait, hang on. No, yep, no, I read that wrong. The only movie podcast that you're currently listening to. Hello, Pod. I'm Ali Plum, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. As you may have noticed, I am not Chris Hewitt, who is in Comic-Con, and I am not Helen O'Hara, who is on holiday somewhere that isn't here, and I'm not Phil the Semelin, who can't be me, because he's right in front of me, sitting there, looking at his intelligent, handsome, nearby face. I can tell he is in dire need of an introduction that doesn't mention art house films or subtitles. So, Phil, I'm going to tell you how nice you look. Phil, you look nice.
Thanks, Ali.
Did I nail it?
Yeah.
Good.
I missed the art house introduction a little bit.
You absolute prick. Ben is another person also in the room. He is here in our special, of course. We've been doing a lot of this lately. Three-man pod booth. He is our third man, a man so offensively pleasant, it's almost pleasantly offensive. It's our occasionally resident nice guy, Ben Kirby. Ben, you look nice today.
Thank you. That's very kind. That was pleasant of you also.
Thanks, man.
We're so pleasant.
So bloody
this
pleasant.
This is pleasant, isn't it?
Should we dial it down a bit?
What? The pleasantries?
You're both a bunch of fuck knuckles.
Oh, ouch.
That's better.
That's better.
You've come back from Rome recently, haven't you?
I have.
Did you pay a visit to Cinecittà?
To where?
Studios.
No. Where's that?
It's in Rome, I believe.
Oh, okay. That's a shame. I haven't even seen The Great Beauty. I felt like I was really missing out. I should have done my homework before I came.
What did you do out there?
I just wandered around wondering what these places were. Not recognising them for cinema.
More on that story later.
As it develops.
Right, so we, as we often do, are going to start with some questions that are sent from you guys. All of these ones are from Facebook. Imagine that.
Tremendous.
Tremendous. Bring them the hell on. Dave Sparks, there's no at symbols obviously on Facebook, or so I'm told. The podcast before last, you mentioned Scotland getting a certain animated movie a week before the UK. That's likely because school holidays often start a week earlier in Scotland, so the films are released at the start of the holidays.
Oh,
so,
is that what it is? Yeah, this is How to Train Your Dragon 2,
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And we should have twigged that. It's quite foolish. Same goes for Ireland. They don't operate on the same way we do, and by we I mean England and Wales, I guess. Anyway, here's his question. A schoolish question for the podcast. Which film school kid can you most relate to? Not who you'd want to be, but who you were most like.
Luke Perry from Beverly Hills 90210. Not really film, is it? But that was me.
That was you?
Yeah.
Well, if we're not doing films, then I was Seth Cohen from The OC, obviously.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I was nothing like Luke Perry whatsoever. More like Pedro, I think, from Napoleon Dynamite. With a little Max Fisher, a rocker blazer.
Vote Phil.
If you have ever seen a photograph of me, and God bless you if you have, and survived, I look, or have looked, just like Napoleon Dynamite in my perhaps younger years. Not as young as I'd like them to have been years. So yeah, I guess I have to say Napoleon Dynamite.
Is that what the beard is in aid of?
Yeah, the beard's essentially just for protection from Napoleon Dynamite comparisons. For a time, I was also compared to Mr. Tumnus, but I don't think he's ever gone to school. So he's probably not a valid answer to this question. Mr. Tumnus was a big one. Yeah, people would come up to me.
But Mr. Tumnus was a fully grown fawn.
Yeah.
And you were just a small child.
I was once.
Very hairy child, though.
I was such a hairy baby. I can't think of that many real... The people I'd like to be, when I would love to be Ferris Bueller so much. He is just the coolest guy. To call him a school kid doesn't seem right because he's not really at school.
Everyone wants to be him.
I think I'm more Cameron. I'm actually older than I look, and I do kind of passable voices, but not really.
But you're not ravaged by horrible depression?
Let's not get into that.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. Fuck you. Ben, who's your school kid?
Well, if we're being completely honest, probably it's going to have to be maybe Oliver from Submarine.
Ah.
Very pretentious, very smug and awful and smarmy, and tries to see life as a film. Nouvelle Vague in his case. Had a thing for hats and tried to make hats work for a while. I tried that and it didn't work out.
What hat did you try most before you realised it was wrong?
I don't think I should. It's just too embarrassing.
Deerstalker?
I had a Trilby for a while.
Ah.
That was bad. I was like 12, but it wasn't good.
You're listening to Empire Podcast's Hat Confessions.
Yeah, it really is a confession. It's less Welsh, and my mum never had an affair with a judo instructor, but apart from that, as far as I know, I mean, who knows?
Drop her a text.
Yeah, I should have found out now. But yeah, that's probably the closest comparison I can think of. Either that or probably Will from The Inbetweeners. Although once someone did say that they thought I seemed like I had a lot of allergies, which I don't have any allergies, but she was convinced, like, that's allergy kid.
It's the ultimate insult.
I know, it's just like, so what allergies do you have? As if I had some, and I don't.
Was she hitting on you?
If she was, she was doing it very badly. She's really going for the sort of self-esteem hit.
Do you want to go back to my place and compare allergies? It could happen. The Inbetweeners are a great show too, though obviously in their filmic form, they're not doing much school kiddery. They're just being, you know, shoved into ants' nests and falling off.
I did go to Malia after school as well, so I'm pretty similar.
Shit.
And I read Jane Eyre on the beach.
Classy.
I could probably relate to, speaking if we're going to broaden this to TV, the Fresh Meat crew. That's uni though, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I'm sorry.
I thought you better say Fresh Prince, and that's just not true.
The Fresh Prince.
You are just not the Fresh Prince.
Did you go to uni early, Phil? Were you some wunderkind?
Yeah, I went to uni age 7.
Okay.
I got a master's.
I think you're more Jazzy Jeff now, I think about it.
Jazzy Jeff.
You know, Fresh Prince.
Yeah. Who is the Fresh Prince's close but little buddy?
Alfonso is the actor.
Carlton.
I love how you know him by his actual voice. Carlton. Yeah, yeah, I have a friend who is Carlton. His nickname was Carlton. So I guess technically that would make me Will Smith in Fresh Prince, potentially.
Well, you look pretty similar as well.
Thanks. It's a good question, actually, because when I was at school, like Nightmare and Elm, if you'd watch the horror movies of the day, the nightmares, and you come back and you'd have just
that was the same for me. I remember I was talking about The Exorcist and how someone said their dad had vomited with terror when he went to see it, and we were like,
yeah. You'd have to go, more, my dad is Satan. Yeah.
Well, I saw Scream when I was 9
and
was genuinely traumatised by it. And that was on Christmas Eve, and it had ruined Christmas Day for me because I didn't sleep a wink that night.
Of course you bloody didn't.
But I was cool because I'd seen Scream, so, you know.
For me, it's a payoff, isn't it? You were really tired, but cool.
Yeah.
For me, it was all the... any Mafia film. Any Mafia film at my school was the coolest thing. Like, you know, The Godfather was the coolest thing, or, you know, Goodfellas was just totally... you were cool. But yeah, it's always the horrors. In fact, the one cool thing I had involving film is that somebody who I won't mention managed to get hold of a Jurassic Park like bootleg copy before it came to England. So I was watching it on VHS on a tiny, tiny screen on a friend of a friend's like sofa, and I just thought I was the coolest guy ever. And do you remember when you were younger, when people, you tell them, oh, I've watched this great film everyone's excited about, and they just said, oh, tell me what happens, and you ended up for the whole of lunch break telling them the exact story of the film, and that was just you, king of the hill, like...
Yeah, nobody said, spoiler!
Yeah, no. This is kind of pre-internet days, though, where people can just Google exactly what it is, or look on Putlocker or whatever to watch something illegally. On VHS, God.
Yeah, I know.
Smuggled it out.
I don't know how it worked out, honestly. Honestly, I was for like 3 days cool, and then of course that actually came out in cinemas. So that's a different answer to a different question, but I love that question. I'd like to hear what Chris and Helen would say in terms of, like, you know, what films were cool. So make a mental note.
Welcome. I want to know what they were like at school.
Welcome to the Empire Film Piracy Podcast with Ali Plum, your host and chief pirate.
Chief pirate, not captain. Chief pirate.
As he dons his eye patch.
Let us move on to another question from Bobby Hill, this one. Thank you, Bobby Hill. Empire Podcast question. Here is a question for all you lovely people. It's obvious that you all have a deep love for movies, but did any of you actually have any aspirations to get into the film business instead of film journalism? And now, knowing what you know and what we've seen, if you had to get into the movie game, what job, in front or behind of the camera, would you like to try or even think you might be good at? He then gives us a compliment, which is far too complimentary, and I'm going to have to not mention it. Love, Bobby.
Oh.
Nice, Bobby.
Very nice indeed. Facebook people are lovely.
They are.
Not that Twitter people aren't lovely. They're lovely too.
No, but they have more room to be lovely.
But Bebo wankers.
Yeah. Fucking Bebo.
Come on, let's be honest. We throw in the bin every week.
MySpace scum. No, not really. Sorry if there's anyone out there, isn't there? What a waste of time.
We're joking, but seriously, if anybody on Friendster contacts us again, I will
Friendster?
I will come round
your house.
Is
that a thing?
Not anymore.
What is Friendster?
Do you remember it was... already old by the time it came out, but the movie I'm Just Not That Into You, or He's Just Not That Into You, has Drew Barrymore's character meet somebody off MySpace.
Yeah.
And it is, at the time, the most achingly old.
Like at the time the film came out.
Is it a Fox production though? Because that might explain it. Because Murdoch owns.
No, this is way back. This is before it was a thing, I think. Or maybe you're right. I don't know. It could have been a tie-in.
I just being conspiracy theorist.
You know how Sony movies, like, oh god, Sony movies always have Sony Vios, and now Vios don't exist. So even though the movie was made 3 years ago, you can still see Vios everywhere, and everyone's. What is the name of that movie where it wasn't like Friends with Benefits, but it was Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis, and they play in one section for about 3 or 4 minutes, that PS3 Wii wannabe?
Is it Friends with Benefits? Or is that the other one? There were two that came out about
the same time. I think it was Friends with Benefits. Anyway, that's again a different answer to a different question. If you could be behind the camera or in front of the camera or be part of the movie-making business, what would it have been? And did you ever have any dreams of being in that position?
Yeah, I wanted to be a stuntman.
Did you really?
Yeah. I don't think I did, actually. I was quite afraid of most things, especially brutal injuries.
They're the worst.
I'm not sure I ever... I sort of semi-still do harbour those things, so I don't want to rule myself out. If Brian Glazer should call, will help.
Your brother did it, didn't he start out?
He did. That's how he got into this. He worked as a runner on the first Harry Potter. Harry Potter and the...
You can do this.
The Philosopher's Sorcerer. And we went to, I remember going to the rap party of that film, actually, and that must have been, well, it was a long time ago, let's be honest. And then he also worked on, that was with Christopher Columbus, he used to scour Watford for sushi, for like yellowfin tuna for Chris Columbus, who hadn't quite got his head around the fact that the Hertfordshire market wasn't quite as reflective of Asian Pacific cuisine as Los Angeles. Like, what did he do after that? I can't remember. But yeah, he did that. I mean, look, as a runner, it's a really good intro to the movie business. David Heyman, we when we spoke to him about Gravity, he said that he started off doing that. He worked as a runner on David Lean's Passage to India and taught him some important lessons about movie making. I'd always imagine it's one of those things that you sort of need to know that you want to do almost immediately and really pursue it relentlessly. And
as I'm sure many people have,
the only thing I was pursuing relentlessly in those days was sort of
horror movies,
my football team and girls, and yeah, horror movies. So not then, maybe more now, I suppose, especially with a view to writing.
I had a period of wanting to be part of like actually making movies, and I managed to get some work experience at, surprisingly enough, you know, coincidentally, on a Harry Potter film, which reveals my age actually, and it was for Goblet of Fire. And I originally came in for like 2 or 3 weeks to help with the publicity department because that's where I managed to get the placement. Then over the course of the next few days, it dawned on them that they didn't have enough for me to do. So I ended up going down to the costume department and spent about 4 or 5 days with the costume department because, and this is just, I don't care. I knew how to tie a tie. So they needed somebody to tie ties for like 300 kids every day.
Is that a rare skill?
It turns out
you had to do it on them.
I had to do it on them. I had to do it quickly. It had to be a double win. I had to be just done. Yeah. And you just had to flip it or whatever. So they gave me as like a present a Slytherin tie and a Gryffindor tie, which I've since lost. But anyway, it was a really good time. And it just made me feel like, overwhelming feeling when I was there was that, Jesus Christ, it's hot. Any movie, you just presume it's going to be a pleasant experience to just shoot the whatever. But inside, and you go now to where they've changed it, in Leavesden, where they've done now the Harry Potter experience up there. And it's funny, I'm tempted to go back just to see how much has actually changed. It was just a constant blast of fans in between shots, people looking incredibly bored. But if you looked around the set, the level of detail was extraordinary. On the side of the cereal packets, it had little in-jokes. You'd never see them on screen. Those floating plates of sausages in the Great Hall, they were all like perfectly glistening or whatever, but obviously were plastic and you could throw them at people. Inside the fireplace, there were little inscriptions and graffiti, and that just blew my mind. And I just kind of realised whilst I was there, this is wonderful. But like you say, Phil, you've got to love it, and you've got to really, really want to be there because it is hard work, even if you are just tying ties or, as I was for a period, you know, carrying props here and there.
Are you on the credits of the film?
Oh, no. Like, it was a placement. Like, it wasn't like a...
I've got a friend who was on the credits for Eden Lake, but they spelled his name wrong. And he was like, well, great, that was 2 months of my life.
What was his name?
I can't say. Or can I say? I don't know.
I don't know. No. Legally,
he's still working in films, so maybe I shouldn't. Ooh, hello. I think they'll get the credit right eventually. Okay. But I also, before that, he was making short films, and the only experience I've had on film sets is on his short films, which I sort of helped produce. I didn't really know what producing involved, so it just meant me getting in the way a lot and being on set and really annoying the cinematographer,
who was
really, really good.
That's how you do it.
So with all my stupid suggestions, so in the end, I just made lots of cup of tea. So maybe the career that's cut out for me is catering on film sets, just making tea.
And... your craft services.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so interesting. I never knew that about you, Ali.
You never.
I mean, not that yours was interesting too.
Fine, I'm boring.
Sorry, Ben. No. That was terrible. Great story.
Thanks.
What but nice I guy. Didn't know that about you, about the Thai thing. You've never mentioned it before.
When I host the podcast, I always, you know, like to bring out the big anecdote.
I'm looking
guns.
Forward to the next, to the second act of this podcast. It's to find out what more revelations.
It's incredible.
Lie ahead. I do have to say, though, I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but I did notice that in the Goblet of Fire, the quality of Thais was significantly diminished from the other films in the canon.
Isn't there? Yeah, on that
just
installment.
All over the place with the kids. It really took me out of the movie. Sorry, anyway, go on.
Right, we have one last very quick question. This is from Jack Kennelly. What are your first date deal-breaker movies? If you discover, say, that the girl or boy of your dreams has not seen Wayne's World, would that be enough to put you off your burgeoning romance of the century? So essentially, this is the idea of a deal-breaker. It might be they don't put they put heart on the top of the eye, and that's enough for you to realise that we're never going to be lovers. What is the movie equivalent of You Smoke, and it's just not going to work out for you guys?
I've had to be very tolerant because my girlfriend, I only realised recently, has never heard of Tom Hanks.
I do not believe you.
Yep. It's like not having heard of Spades or...
Rice.
Yeah. It's just like, how has that passed you by? And then I have another friend who hadn't heard of The Muppets.
Hadn't heard of The Muppets?
Yeah. She didn't know what The Muppets were. She
had to have when I arrived at university... Hello, Warwick. How you doing? Roots A Block for life. There was a girl in my corridor who had never eaten a pizza. I immediately went and bought a pizza, cooked it for her, and her response was, that's quite nice.
I went on a date with a girl who hadn't heard of Barack Obama. No, not recently. This was before he was elected president. But it wasn't that far before.
Was he running for president?
It was a year before he was elected president. So, like, he was kind of a thing in quite a big way at that point, and she had no idea who he was. But that was okay. I mean, she was probably a lot cleverer than I am, but it just struck me as a bit like, how are you missing that page of the newspaper every day?
Is there one, though, that really, like a film that you just
das
say
Boot.
That you have to heard of it?
Das Boot.
Really?
No, I don't have that, really.
Yes,
I don't
you do.
Have that.
You do. And
I don't think so.
Eagle has landed.
I've never met a girl who's seen Eagle Has Landed.
Have you?
Put it this way, it would be a massive bonus if they had seen the Eagle. A massive bonus if they had seen Eagle Has Landed.
Have you ever stormed off in the middle of a date?
I have never done that, no.
I would love it if you just asked, look, first question, I'm just going to ask it, have you ever seen Eagle Has Landed? No, what's that? And then you just leave.
Just flip the table. I think maybe for me it's like Annie Hall or maybe even Shaun of the Dead. And if they haven't seen them, and then I show them to them and they still don't like them, then it's kind of like, what are we still doing together?
That's the thing, yeah. If you sit down with someone and you watch Annie Hall and they just don't like it, that probably would slightly make me wonder a little bit.
Yeah, you think you've got a dead shark on your hands.
A dead shark.
But of course, you know, whilst you're watching the film, she's, you know, taking a lobster and poking it in your face and it's snapping at you and you're getting a bit awkward.
There's ways around it, yeah.
There are ways around it. You can forgive them.
If our conversation is subtitled, I'd be happy.
Time for our first guest. Jason Blum is the diabolical genius behind Blumhouse Productions, known best for producing very successful horror films like the Paranormal Activity franchise, Sinister, Insidious, and believe it or not, The Tooth Fairy, a movie where Dwayne The Rock Johnson plays The Tooth Fairy. Ridiculous. What next? A Greek demigod? Anyway, Jason Blum is just the man to speak to about all things horror and all things producery. And a day after hosting a press conference with the man, Phil Desemlian, that's you.
Yeah.
Interviewed him again for the Empire podcast, and I came along for the ride. Enjoy. My name is Ali Plum, and your name is Jason Blum.
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 Yes.
So you're Blum.
I'm Blum, rhymes with plum. Your name is really Plum?
I know, right?
P-L-U-M?
Yeah.
Plum?
Yes.
I've been called your name my whole life.
Are you kidding me?
No.
We're brothers.
We're brothers.
From a very disparate group of mothers.
What nationality is that, Plum? Do you know?
That's entirely English. Plum, plumbing. I'm guessing.
Plum, plumbing?
Yeah.
Was that your family?
Well, it's from, lead, plum, plumber.
Wow,
yeah.
I love
my
it.
My question for you is there Dutch in your family?
No.
The name Blum?
No, my father, Polish, Austrian, no
yeah.
Dutch. But when I was in Germany, it Bloom, and they all think it's flower, but there's no E. But I wasn't, there's no German in me.
So do people call your production, you know, your production house is now this gigantuan monolith.
Hardly.
Blumhouse?
They call it Blumhouse, yes.
And we've been saying...
Blumhouse. You've been saying Blumhouse?
Yeah.
No, it's Blumhouse.
Now we know!
It's Blum. Yes. Yes.
Hooray!
You'll never forget it.
There it
never.
Is. You also have a very cool middle name, I believe.
Ferris. My middle name is Ferris. So my father had a gallery in L.A. in the late 50s, and it was called the Ferris Gallery, and he named me after that, which I thought was a little weird to name your kid after your business. Like, I'm at, like, if my kid was called Blumhouse, that would be a little weird, but it's an original name.
Joey Blumhouse.
But Blum. I got, yeah, but I got Ferris Wheel, which was terrible, and I got Plum, which you wouldn't think was terrible because that was your name, but I was very upset by that.
Oh, no, I thought it was terrible, too.
No, you did.
I mean, I don't tell my dad, but, yeah, there's a never-ending source of embarrassing rhyming words for that.
So oh, there really is.
It's just so wonderful.
We touched on this last night, the DIY thing. I taught you
DIY.
The meaning of
do
DIY.
It yourself.
Do it yourself.
I've never heard that expression in my life.
But
that is English. We don't say that in America.
You can take that home with you if you
like. Yeah, I'm going to. I can't
put it
wait.
In
I'll start a trend. I can't wait.
Yeah, America never really got the entrepreneurial spirit, did they?
No. Yeah. No, that was you guys.
Totally.
You can that have DIY and you can have crikey. But on that larger scale DIY thing, I'm desperate to ask you about the Blumhouse of Horror. A Simpsons riffing.
Oh, the Blumhouse of Horror.
Did it have one of those kind of weird mirrors that makes you just distorts you?
No,
how scary was it?
It wasn't fun. There was nothing fun about this. This was scary. That's like a fun house. This was a very, very scary haunted house. We did it 2 years. We took over a big building in downtown LA, and we hired all our people from the crew, like our special effects people and everything. And we went on this 4-story adventure through the Blumhouse of Horrors. The mythology was that there was a, it was in a building from the 20s, and that there was a vaudeville act, and there was this magician, and he by accident sawed a woman, the magic trick where you saw someone in half and they're not in half. Well,
yeah.
He actually cut her in half, and her ghost haunted the theater for decades to come.
Crumba.
Did at any point Ethan Hawke run out with a machete?
No, but we tried to get him to do that.
Oh.
We really tried. I wanted him so badly to come with a machete or something.
What are you doing about Halloween, Ethan? We need you for 3 days to hide in a dark space.
Ethan's been slow to embrace horror, but he hated horror. He couldn't stand them.
I was going to ask.
Oh, hates them. Doesn't hate them anymore, but couldn't stand them. And we're really, really good friends. We've been friends forever. And I'm like always trying to get, I was always trying to get him to do one. And he was always making fun of me for making horror movies. Thank you very much. And he turned down Insidious. And then we sent him a bunch more, but turned out a bunch more. And then he finally agreed to do Sinister. And the reason that I was saying this before, the reason that he didn't want to do a horror movie is because the reason he doesn't like horror movies is because he doesn't like the feeling of being scared in a cinema, which I understand a lot of people don't. And he thought actually making one, you were going to have that feeling.
Oh, no.
But exactly. I mean, they're kids and tutors and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. It's not a scary thing on a horror movie set. So we actually had a great time. And then we did it again on The Purge. And now he's doing a Western for us, which everyone thinks we're nuts. We're doing a Western with Ethan and John Travolta. It started yesterday in New Mexico. And Westerns typically don't do well at all. So everyone is very, but it's very cheap, so we can't get hurt too badly.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Jason, you're nuts.
I know. I'm crazy to do a Western. I know.
Not
really
a horror Western.
It actually kind of is a horror Western.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Oh. I love Westerns, though, and I'm sad that there aren't.
Want to hear the story?
Yeah. Give us the story.
I'll give you the short story. Ethan's best friend his whole life is a dog. The dog is amazing and can do everything. And the dog that we cast in the movie is this incredible dog who actually can't do anything. They're best friends. They go into a little town. It's 1880. He gets into a bar fight scuffle. No big deal. He's been in them his whole life. He goes and leaves the town and sets up his camp like he's done for his whole life, 2 miles outside of town. He goes to sleep. The guy he was in the bar fight with comes to find him in his camp. Kills the dog. Terrible. Ethan goes back to the town, kills everybody in the town.
I'm in.
That's the movie.
I'm in.
End.
You had me a dog.
All right, good.
But what's the dog called? We need to know.
Jumpy.
Jumpy.
Yeah, Jumpy.
And Jumpy didn't have a problem with like the horror genre.
Jumpy, he had to sign. He signed a few releases. He's got about 7 lawyers. Jumpy.
Trouble with Jumpy.
It was a heavy, heavy negotiation.
It's not that he doesn't like horror. It's just that he doesn't like the experience of being scared in the cinema. That's Jumpy's major
Jumpy
problem.
Thought he was going to be scared. Jumpy thought he was going to get really jumpy on set, but we calmed him down.
Yeah, you got to.
Of course, obviously.
You've known Ethan for a very long time, and it's worth mentioning before you went to work for major studios, you worked for the Weinsteins. You were in theatre.
I was. We had a theater company.
You had a theater company.
Malapart. Yeah.
I just wondered if that kind of there's anything from that sort of theatrical world that you took with you, or anything that you learned early on in terms of the way that you operate now?
I took two things with me. I actually got it from, not to go back to the Ferris Gallery, but when I was growing up, we spent a lot of time with painters and artists. So I'm very comfortable with them and friendly. Those are mostly my friends are that way, even though I'm not. So the theater company was kind of an extension of that. And the way that the theater company experience has affected our business now is that we hire mostly actors who haven't done scary movies, which is counterintuitive. Like most people are like, oh, this, like they, the general Hollywood thinking is you should hire people who've been in successful scary movies to do other scary movies. And I like to hire actors like Ethan who haven't, or don't know them, or don't like them, or feel like have an uncomfortable relationship with scary movies. Cause I think, I don't know. I think it makes them feel fresh and different. So that's the biggest thing for the theater company.
Have you seen Boyhood yet? Yeah. Terrifying.
And Boyhood is
with the zombies. So scary.
No, did you see it?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you see it?
We did.
I think it's definitely my favorite movie of the year. Mm. Maybe of the last few years. I thought it was a great movie.
It's got this incredible twist where this kid grows up over the course of 11 years and that's it.
He goes to college.
Yeah, that's it.
And he kills everyone. Because his dog's dead.
That's it.
You don't know. Not many people waited for the credit sting, but it gets pretty hairy.
Come on, that movie was good.
That movie was incredible.
It was amazing.
I can't say to talk about the film sounds like you're kind of taking the mick. Really, you just go, you can't be that good. No, it is.
No, it is. I know. It really is.
We can't just talk about another movie.
We can't talk about Boyhood.
Although it is a universal movie.
It's another universal movie.
Let's talk about The Purge Anarchy. Because you mentioned last night that there will be more, probably.
I hope so.
At what point do you decide? Because you very specifically don't plan a sequel until the film's out, which seems like a good way of going about things. At what point do you go? Is it the first weekend figures, or do you already kind of have projections in place? Have you already got the next one in place?
Well, those are a lot of questions. We definitely have we always have projections. They're not always right, but we're always projecting. If it's a massive opening weekend, we're definitely thinking about the sequel right away. But then there's kind of a gray zone where it might happen or it might happen, and then we have to wait for the run of the movie. And if it bombs, there's no sequel.
Okay.
It's very sad.
And what are your feelings about The Purge?
I think The Purge is going to be... I love the movie. Otherwise, I wouldn't be out on this crazy, crazy world tour. So I think the movie's going to do really well. I feel very bullish about it.
The response from the screening last night was pretty fantastic.
Good.
Everyone seemed to enjoy that.
People seem to like it.
Any movie in which Michael K. Williams turns up with a shotgun, a la Omar from The Wire.
I mean, how can you go wrong?
Can't go wrong.
That's our third movie.
I was going to say, you mentioned that his character, who, just to sort of give a potted summary, he's the rebellious paramilitary type organization, which is fighting back against this the new founding fathers.
He's the kind of one of the few people with a moral center in the movie. But go on, sorry.
Yes, no, I was just going to say that you mentioned that might be the scope for another for the next movie or the movie after that, potentially.
I'd like it to be Purge Revolution.
Okay.
Be cool, right?
Is he signed up for, do you have your actors signed up to contracts, or how does it all work?
You know, honestly, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. I'm not sure if he is or he isn't, but I would think he would like to come back. I don't know if he specifically, but Frank and all the actors have seen the movie and they were psyched about the movie. So that's always a good sign.
You mentioned you might call it Purge Revolution. How difficult is it in that meeting to pick the name? Because The Purge, amazing name. It's so enticing.
We weren't going to call it The Purge.
No.
Yes. You know what we were going to call it? Vigilandia.
Vigilandia.
Is that good or bad?
Are you kidding? Would Vigilandia.
Is that terrible?
That sounds like a drink. I'll have three Vigilandias. Hold the olives. Thanks.
But Purge sounds like throwing up. Yeah, so there was a lot of James wanted to call it The Purge to give him he deserves all the credit for the title. Then all of the geniuses, myself at the top of the list, were like, I don't think we should call it The Purge. Mm-hmm. We came up with a million other titles. Vigilandia. In fact, I have a t-shirt that says Vigilandia because for a while that really was the title.
Wow.
Then we went back to The Purge. But it is, now it's a great title. But at the time...
Vigilandia reminds me slightly of Portlandia and the idea that what The Purge night would look like in Portland. Where
by the way,
I
would love The Purge in Portland. They would be so upset about it.
Yeah, I'm going to kill you, but
we could kill all the
pacifists. With espressos.
With espressos. I'm going to kill you with feathers.
Yes.
Yeah. Tickled to death.
We did talk about the idea of like The Purge in England and what that might look like. The Purge Queensbury Rules was one idea that we had just spitballing yesterday.
Yeah, The Purge with no guns.
Mm. Gun free.
Cool, right?
Just cricket bats.
I thought I'd love it.
It might be a little longer. Might be just a little longer.
It's, well, the thing is,
it would be a week in here.
It would take an awfully long time.
Well, first of all, take 2 or 3 days for people to kind of get going. You know, and then...
Well,
you
know. I've got to finish my tea.
Yeah,
McClaxon's gone. Hang on.
Yeah.
You know the scene in Shaun of the Dead where zombies come into the back garden and they're just trying to... They don't have any weapons.
Right,
so they go at them with swing ball.
Yeah.
This is our problem, I think, in Purge Night. What are you going to use?
Purge. Maybe it's a comedy in the UK. Purge is it's a comedy. It's like a cousin of the Purge, and we do the Purge.
You've worked with Stephen Merchant in your time.
I have.
Stephen Merchant, the Purge, him just looking at all these things, carrying a cricket bat going.
He would obviously be the star of the UK Purge.
I think you should genuinely call it the Purge
Stephen
comedy.
Stephen Merchant. The Purge colon. Stephen Merchant, colon, comedy.
Right, well, that's sorted. I was looking through, as you do, your list of films, what you have done. How many films do you know off the top of your head? How many films did you produce that came out last year?
That came out last year?
Yeah, how many films that you produced came out last year?
Like four?
Four. And how many this year?
Like five.
Next year? It's going to be six, right?
It's going to be six, yeah. I like to add one a year.
You are setting yourself some pretty high standards.
I know, I don't mess around.
It's going to get to the stage where in 2020...
Every movie is going to be a Blumhouse movie.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's my goal. Why would anyone else... I mean, what else is there?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean...
Who would stop you?
Yeah, who's... No one.
No. I just do think it's extraordinary. There's an exponential increase. When do you stop?
Well, we get a hard time about that a lot. I have to say that the thing that we do not quite fair, because all our movies, it's almost like an episodic, it's almost like giving someone a hard time for producing 20 episodes of TV, because all of our movies are the same budget. They all shoot in LA. They're all like $4 million. They all shoot for 20, 22 days. They all shoot in Los Angeles. So unlike other production companies, this is not a negative or a positive, but unlike other production, every movie isn't an entirely new endeavor. It's not a $100 million movie in Romania and a $20 million movie in Chicago and a $60 million comedy in South Korea. It's all unified, which makes it easier to make more movies. Also, I don't like, and this is, again, a personal thing. The fun thing about the movies is there's a lot of ways to succeed at it, but I don't like laboring decisions and being incredibly precious about every single thing. I feel like good movies beget good movies and good work begets good work, and I don't like overthinking stuff, which is great. If you make expensive movies, you have to overthink because it'd be irresponsible not to. But if you make inexpensive movies, you can have kind of a fluidity to the creative process. Sounds really pretentious.
No, I get it.
Do you really?
No, I do. Okay. I mean, look, honestly, if I would do your model because I keep making terrible decisions and I'd rather not labor over them.
Decide quicker.
Exactly. Make the mistake quicker.
Fail fast, fail often.
Is that the expression?
Did Scott talk to you at all before he took the gig over at Marvel?
Yeah, he did a lot.
Yeah. Did he?
Yeah.
Because you
I
just
was heartbroken.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's my guy.
He's your guy, but everyone's saying great that he's taking over. He's taking Doctor Strange.
I know. I'm really happy about that. And I'm also James Wan is doing Fast and Furious, and I was really happy. I love, the better part of me loves when a director works with us and then goes on to do a huge movie, which is if that's what they want to do. The less better part of me is a little sad that I'm not doing. You know what I mean? I feel kind of abandoned.
How does Scott protect himself from what happened with, say, Edgar Wright on Ant-Man?
You can't protect yourself from that. It's just he had a bunch of conversations with them. They had a bunch of conversations with him, obviously, and they both think they're on the same page, and 99% chance they are on the same page.
Yeah.
But there's always a 1% chance that they aren't. But that's any big movie. That's not Marvel. Any big movie. That's the kind
of... When you're playing with hundreds of millions of dollars...
Yeah.
You know,
there's risk.
Yeah.
Then the decisions are long and intense. I would never want to make those movies. I love watching them, but I would never want to make them.
I really wish I could be there when you, I can only imagine this though, Scott shows you his first cut of the film. I can imagine there'd be some kind of, what do you reckon?
Of the Marvel movie?
Yeah, for Doctor Strange.
You're going to get to look at that early on. Can we come?
Either way, can I tell you something? I highly doubt it.
You reckon?
Not because Scott and I, Scott's producing Sinister 2, and we talk all the time, and we have a great relationship and respect each other, and I actually show him cuts of our movies all the time. But Marvel is so, I mean, I think if Scott showed anyone the movie, they would burn his house down. Like, they're so secretive. That's like this old Hollywood, like, which I can't stand that. Like, we tweet pictures from the sets. We invite people to the sets. We're like, I think that's like very old, antiquated idea of like you have to keep everything secret until the movie comes out. I don't subscribe to that. But then again, you know, I don't make those huge movies.
Yeah, they're doing the hype machine, and I don't think you can quite do the hype machine with Sinister 3.
I think you're right. You think that's why they do it, to create hype?
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, it's the hype machine.
No, I think that's because they think they want the audience to be surprised. When you go see Star Wars, they don't want anyone to know what the story is.
Yeah, but it does add to the mythos. Sparkly dust in the air.
I guess you're right, yeah.
We weren't going to use the word mythos.
I'm really offended that you don't think Sinister 3 is going to have... I mean, I can't believe it.
I don't think it has $100 million marketing hype machine.
I just don't believe it.
I know, right? where's the superhero, man? I mean,
where's the superhero? We're going to check. Bagul flies in Sinister 3.
Oh, okay.
He flies. I don't know. I'm not a huge Marvel fan. What is the Doctor Strange's, what is his special talent?
He's a medical doctor.
Oh, he's a medical doctor?
He can make people better when they're ill.
Is that a big deal?
No, he's a sorcerer supreme.
He's a sorcerer?
Not just a sorcerer, but a supreme.
Is that a really well-known character in the UK?
Not really, no. It's probably one of the hardcore Marvel fans, I think it's one of those. Next tier down.
Got it. I've really revealed myself as not a hardcore Marvel fan. Embarrassing.
Go home.
I've got to leave. Did you see the blow-up thing I did for the plane? That was the craziest
I heard about
thing.
The blow-up thing you did for the plane.
That was my best invention.
This is amazing, because the way the story I read, I think it was in Business Week.
Yes.
Which is even more highbrow than the Empire podcast.
Way highbrow and hardcore.
That's what I talk about anymore.
Yeah, okay.
Instead of booking, you went to Morocco, is that correct?
Correct.
You didn't want to go first class.
No, too expensive.
So you booked a row of seats in
three seats.
Coach. Three
a
seats.
Row makes it sound extravagant.
Okay, sorry.
It was my wife and I traveling, so two of us for three seats, go on.
Okay. And then you bought an inflatable, I don't know how this would have worked on a, I mean.
Shall I explain
it? Yeah, please tell us.
Three coach seats. First of all, I got the layout of the plane. So it's two seats on either side with an aisle, and in the middle is three across. Got it?
Got it.
Okay, so I bought both aisle seats on the three across, and the middle seat, very hard to buy an empty seat. Most airlines won't let you do it. Air Maroc will if you have a note from a doctor saying you have a bad back, which I happen to have. So I got the empty seat. Got the three seats. So my wife is on one aisle, I'm on the other, empty seat in the middle. Then I had online, they'll tell you the distance between the front of your seat and the back of where the tray table comes out, which is like 10 inches where your knees go. And then they tell you how far down it is, how much is, which is another like 12 inches. And then at the floor, it's actually a little wider. So it's actually the shape of a trapezoid. That may be hard to understand, but maybe it isn't. So I went to an inflatable company, which do exist in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, of course. Mostly they make big things that you put outside, like Burger King, an inflatable burger. But they made a shape that fit exactly in that space, in that negative space. And they made it for me custom. It cost $500. So the whole thing was $2,000. And the two business class, the two first class seats were $20,000, $10,000 a piece. So for $2,000, I got my two seats and I got my inflatable. Now, the only catch, the only thing that almost didn't work, but again, happily was Air Maroc. If it was American or if it was American Airlines, it would have been a disaster. But they give you a kind of a gun that pumps it up, that you press. It's an electric inflator. Security stopped me for that. They said, what is that? I said, that's my electric inflator. They said, oh, okay. And I showed it to them and they said, okay, let me go, which is pretty funny. The thing about the electric inflator is noisy. So the plane takes off, I get my thing, and then I start inflating it, and people around me are like super edgy. And I explained to everyone what I kind of said, look, this is what I'm doing, da, 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 da. And then they kind of got into it. And by the end, the guy next to me is like, this guy got to be on Shark Tank. So we inflated this thing, and then we could lie next to each other. So my wife lay across the three seats, and I lay on the inflatable right next to her, and the two of us were like two sardines on this thing, and we got to lay down and sleep. And I saved $18,000.
Which you then spanked in the casino.
It's a long story. which immediately, I spent, no, I didn't. I saved it very carefully. I bought 700 suits from Zara.
Thank you so much. That was amazing fun. Real pleasure. Come and see us again for the Purge Revolution.
For Ouija. Ouija in October.
Yes.
Ouija in October is going to be great.
Have you done Ouija board yourself?
When I'm bored, I just put my two hands on the Ouija board and wait for something to happen. So far, nothing's happened, but I've been doing it for years. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for a ghost.
Aren't we all? Thank you so much for coming down.
All right. Thanks for having me. Bye, guys.
Let's move on to our next section. We have lots of stuff going on. Obviously, this week is Comic-Con week. We're recording this on Thursday, which is wonderful, and Comic-Con is taking place over the next few days. Our crack squad of Comic-Conners include Chris Hewitt, as previously mentioned, and James White and James Dyer. They're off harvesting Nerdland for news. We, however, on the regular Empire podcast, will not be talking about too much comic book movies because I am in charge. And that's just the way it goes. We will instead be talking about...
Manimal.
Manimal. Let's talk about Manimal.
Manimal. If you're of a certain age, which I am, but I don't really remember it vividly, there was a TV show in the 70s and 80s, which to describe sounds so preposterous that it's almost unbelievable. But it is basically Batman. But instead of fighting crime, he sort of fights crime. He's a wealthy college professor called Dr. Jonathan Chase who has the power to transform himself into an animal.
So any animal.
Any animal, that's Manimal. Or it could have been called Animan, but it was they went for Manimal. But he normally transformed himself into a hawk or a panther. As our news story points out, that was a budget issue, I think. I don't think the episode where he transformed himself into a blue whale really got past the bean counters. So anyway, that is being made into a movie now.
It is actually a CG live-action hybrid. I would love it to be more cartoony. That would be my ideal situation where it was a bit more like, I don't know, Catch the Pigeon here. But I know it's not going to be. It's a CG live-action hybrid, which obviously will get around the problems that we mentioned earlier, where how do you conceivably, you know, make someone turn into a bear? This will do it through the magic of computer-generated effects.
And it's going to involve Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, the old Anchorman team, the dream team of sort of comic lunatics.
Maybe he'll transform into a sex panther then.
Yes, a very good point.
I would like them to transform into Baxter at least once. That would be wonderful. Or just a big wheel of cheese, which I know isn't an animal, but may technically, depending on how old it is, still be alive.
Yeah,
I quite like the idea of this. He did something similar with Land of the Lost, didn't he? Where he took an old... the McKay-Ferrell team, took an old idea and kind of rejigged it. I don't think that was necessarily the most successful thing they've ever done, but I actually quite like the idea of this. If they get the animation right, it's going to be one of those kind of, hopefully cloudy with a chance of meatballs, rompy fun. And I don't know who pitched Manimal in the first place, but what I will say is, it strikes me as the most obvious, we've come up with a title, let's work backwards, type deal.
And what a title.
And what a title.
Yeah, what a title. I
would be proud to have a DVD that said Manimal on the side of it.
Manimal.
On my shelf, even if it does sound slightly like a porn film.
It's one of those words that's just fun to say, isn't it? You may not want to go and see it at the cinema, but you'll want to ask someone, have you seen Manimal? So people will see it.
Yes.
They'll just want to go and say, can I have 2 tickets for Manimal? That's Manimal. I need 2 tickets for Manimal. Give them to me now.
Manimal 2.
Manimal. Also Starsky and Hutch, of course, which I actually really enjoyed. I don't know how other people feel about Starsky and Hutch as a film, but it made me laugh.
Was that the same gang?
Well, no, probably not, actually.
But it's a similar... I know what you're saying. It's a similar kettle of fish where you take a beloved, quote-unquote, no offence, Manimal. I don't think you're that beloved, but...
No, wait, sorry, we've got to cut that. That's just incompetence on my behalf. I'm happy normally to seem stupid, but if I get completely the wrong people on every front, I think we should cut that.
Okay.
Can we go back?
Just say
to
it
before?
reminds you of what?
Yeah, yeah. No, but tell you what I wanted to say. What's the spy sort of tongue in cheek?
Get Smart.
No, animation. That's one word title. It's a spy thing. It's got he's kind of a set. He does a lot of sexy stuff.
Oh, Archer.
Archer. Yeah. I'm having a difficult time sort of conceiving what this might look like on the screen, but maybe something like Archer, something sort of hammy and tongue-in-cheek, I think is what we can expect. Could be a lot of fun. Who knows?
Yeah, fingers crossed. I've got something which hopefully will be also fun, but it's actually, if you boil it down, a horror, if you actually really get down to it. Westworld. Does anybody remember 1973's Westworld?
Yeah, vividly.
Yul Brynner taking his face off.
Itchy and Scratchy Land, right?
That is essentially what it is. I'm going to take your face. Oh. I have not watched it recently. I remember watching it during the period we were talking about, like when you were a teenager or a school kid and thinking, wow, this is really cool and hokey. But it is this world, a future world, it's Michael Crichton here, where you go to a theme park and you get to be the man with no name. You get to go shoot down all the bad guys in a Wild West world, and they're all androids, so it doesn't matter. They can die, they can come back to life, it's fine, it's all... no problem. Except, of course, when they rebel against their programming, as robots are so often wont to do, and they start killing the humans. That is the essential premise of Westworld. 3 years later, there was another movie called Future World, which was obviously a sequel. And then in 1980, there was a TV show, which I think was called Beyond Westworld. Anyway, since then, there have been rumblings for a long time about whether they'll do something else with this, what they'll do with it, where it would go. Now it turns out that Jonah Nolan, the brother of another Nolan guy, can't think of his first name, bringing together a pretty impressive group of acting folk to create a TV version of Westworld. And it gets better because it's on HBO, which means that it, you know, it's not just TV, and also that it's going to have the budget to really justify it. It's currently only at the pilot stage, so we'll see how it actually pans out. But according to the news that we have to hand, we are looking at the likes of Anthony Hopkins, who'll be playing the role of the chief park owner, runner, devious bastard. And we'll also have Evan Rachel Wood, who's an excellent actress and is going to be playing a character called Dolores, who is an android, and her lover will be played by James Marsden, the utterly handsome and very charming James Marsden, will be playing one of the gunslingers whose job is to die every day. And he's programmed to love Dolores, but can't actually do anything about it because that's just not how it rolls. Then, of course, something happens.
Mm.
Phil, I know you're excited about this one.
I'm quite excited about this. They're not calling them mandroids.
I wish they were.
The manimal thing.
Again, I would watch a movie called Mandroid.
Mandroid.
And again, it sounds like a porn film.
Does a bit, doesn't it? I'm quite excited about this. I really love the film. It's from that kind of era of sci-fis, which have aged with various results, I would say. Some of the effects are good. I mean, Yul Brynner, playing like ultra robot Yul Brynner, you can't argue. And he is sort of the Terminator, isn't he? And this whole Michael Crichton, who also directed the film, premise is basically the precursor for Jurassic Park. It's basically the same story, but with robots instead of dinosaurs. So you could call it Westworld World, I suppose, if you were going to take the whole kind of
that would be amazing.
Jurassic Part 4 formula for the title.
There should be a crossover.
Could be.
You also mentioned the Terminator. They were going to remake it with Arnold Schwarzenegger years ago, apparently.
Is that right?
Yeah, but they never did.
Interesting. Well, I could see why they might. I think it's kind of it's quite a streamlined premise. You know, it's basically a chase movie, isn't it, Westworld?
Yeah.
And
it's interesting that they haven't, talking about Yul Brynner, they haven't mentioned in the course of this announcement whether there'll be a character that will be that gunslinger, yeah, and who will take his role. I feel like that is such a big distinctive part of Westworld, they'd be fools not to, but maybe that won't be part of the pilot, perhaps. But whoever they cast has big boots to fill.
I just quite like the crossover of sci-fi and Western, with the dishonourable exception of Cowboys and Aliens. When you look at something like Battlestar Galactica, when it kind of has that Western
and Firefly
element,
of course.
Yeah, Firefly and Serenity both do that really, really well. Those two, I mean, they are sort of the same thing, aren't they? The West become the final frontier as opposed to the old frontier. So they gel really nicely. And I think this could be, yeah, handled right, it could be a lot of fun.
Just interestingly, just a tidbit on the whole HBO slate. It's always interesting to see what they're doing because they are so often at the forefront of what can be done on TV. They are currently about to lose a few titles in their back catalogue, basically. The Newsroom, Boardwalk Empire and True Blood are all going. So they have a few slots to fill. Currently, they've still got, of course, Game of Thrones, The Leftovers, which is new, of course, and True Detective, which we talked about last week, and Utopia, which is the remake of the currently on-air Channel 4 series, which we're big fans of in The Office. That's being helmed, I believe, or at least being brought to the screen by David Fincher. So very excited about that too. So yeah, if it's all as good as this, like, sign me up. Well done, HBO. Anyway, we must have another news story, and I reckon Ben might have it.
Got something on my sleeve. Ant-Man, we all know, is Edgar Wrightless, and there's been a new poster that's just come out, actually, which wasn't that good.
You're not impressed?
Not a big fan. Anyway, it's going ahead with Peyton Reed. But in the meantime, Edgar Wright has geared up his other project, which he's been talking about for quite a few years. It was going to be post-Scott Pilgrim. It's called Baby Driver, and not that much is known about it. People think it might be a musical. There's no sort of hint of it being a Cornetto trilogy-style film. It's going to be perhaps more action-packed, more in the vein of Scott Pilgrim.
Is it going to be anything to do with the Simon and Garfunkel song of the same
name? That's the speculation, is that I think certain journalists have Googled Baby Driver and come up with the Simon and Garfunkel song and said, well, therefore,
guilty.
It must be connected in some way, which is all about a sort of kid at home who then goes and has his first sexual experiences. So, you know, maybe we'll have some of that from Edgar Wright.
I think it's going to be an interesting conversation between the record company that owns the rights to Baby Driver, because they pretty much got them over a barrel. Would you like to use this song? Yes, I would. Well, name a price, because it's going to be higher than whatever you say. Yeah. We know you need this one.
Poor Edgar Wright.
Yes, no, I mean, that's probably not his biggest worry right now.
No.
Let's just say it. Sounds good. I'm glad he's off to do other stuff, and I'd actually be quite grateful if it was something a little bit more, I don't know, regular, less fantastical. And if it is anything to do with the young man discovering his whatever, that would be perhaps more what I'm interested in.
But it's good to hear that he's actually doing his own project still, and he's not being co-opted by studios and everything else. I'd rather see that than some kind of truncated Ant-Man with him enthralled to Marvel. It'd be better actually to see his own vision on screen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the World's End felt like the natural sort of concluding part of maybe the second phase of his career, and this is, to use Marvel, hijack Marvel parlance, as phase three of Edgar Wright. And it's nice that he's starting off with perhaps something original, something of his own, to head off in a new direction. Good luck to him. And this one apparently not necessarily going to involve his old buddies. So yeah, not much known, but wait to find out more, I guess.
Yeah, watch this space. You know, as mentioned previously, Comic-Con is obviously going on right now, and loads of news is coming out from there. So we won't try and cover that here. Just check out the website over the weekend and over Friday, if you're listening to this on Friday, to make sure you're up to date, because we will be right there at the heart of it. So do check all of that out.
And we have a special web address, don't we, for the whole festival? www.empireonline.com.
Oh, really? That's a very special address for it.
That's the one that we've created for the whole Comic-Con coverage. So head there.
Interesting.
And you'll be greeted with a wealth of news and information.
And stuff.
Can I chuck in one extra news story?
Yes, you can.
We have time.
Sneak it in.
Okay. Sneak it in the back door. Well, because it's not confirmed, but everyone's talking about it, and it is one of those bigger stories of the week, is the rumours about Star Wars that came through Deadline.
Well, this is difficult because it is a rumour. It is entirely unconfirmed. Is this real? Is this not real?
But I think is it worth talking about? It's out there.
Tell me the story as you know it.
Okay, so if you don't want to hear the speculated premise of Star Wars Episode 7, skip ahead a few minutes. So Deadline are reporting that we open with the opening crawl, as you'd expect, and then it pans down and there's a severed hand holding a lightsaber, which is, of course, Luke Skywalker's severed hand from the end of Empire Strikes Back, which has found its way tumbling into space. This then results in a lightsaber going down to a desert planet, which apparently is not Tatooine, and then is found by John Boyega, who apparently plays a stormtrooper, who then takes it to Han and Chewie, who then go on a hunt for Luke Skywalker, who's been gone for 30 years and they don't know where he is. That's the theory. That's what they're saying it is.
How does that work with the time? I mean,
I presumably takes a while. Maybe it's been buried in some desert planet and then it's found for a while, years later.
And everyone's pointed out, presumably, that that's not how space works, and his hand would have burnt up in the atmosphere.
Yep. And the lightsaber.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because the sources seem semi-reputable, but the idea seems semi-preposterous. Who knows?
It's very bold if it's true, and it would be all reliant on good execution.
Can I hit our rumour klaxon on this one? I don't know if it even works.
I'm glad.
I feel like I've done something wrong by talking about Star Wars.
Not aimed at you. Take this with a pinch of
salt. I'm just really glad that we did that before we started talking about it to prevent people from hearing it.
Yeah, that was more just a disclaimer, disclaimer. I just can't. I'm having a tough time sort of visualizing it, really, storyboarding it in my brain, as I like to do. Mm. Like how does he transport the hand to Chewie and Han?
I think he does.
Does
it
in he a, have in oh, a bag?
He's got a moped.
In a case? Like, what? How do you do that? On ice?
Plastic bag.
And then when he gets there, and he doesn't know them, he's going to be like, hey, I know I'm a stormtrooper, or I used to be. I'm not anymore. I'm gone straight now. I'm clean. I've got this for you. And then he opens the ice bucket and takes out a hand with a lightsaber. It's just, I can't see that.
To be honest with you, it's a great thing to talk about in the pub and go, oh, what if this and what if that, and just to get yourself thinking about the movie. But really, I am not paying this any serious attention. If it does happen, wow, that'll be interesting. But it may not and probably won't, so who knows?
On the other hand, though, John Boyega as a stormtrooper excites me. I think that's really interesting and a good basis for a character in Star Wars.
Right, and now it's time for our second interview. Whether he likes it or not, a lot of people best know Brett Ratner for X-Men: The Last Stand, a movie he purposefully designed as an elaborate brain teaser for his old friend Bryan Singer. Think of it as a multi-million dollar Rubik's Cube, only Vinnie Jones is in it and he's the juggernaut bitch. Anyway, where was I? Yes, Rush Hour, which is another film that Brett Ratner directed, as is Rush Hour 2, but not Rush Hour 3, which was of course directed by his old friend Bryan Singer as an elaborate brain teaser for the universe at large. Also on his IMDb page there are the words Red, Dragon, Tower, Heist, and Beverly Hills Cop and 4, which presumably will happen in the future unless Bryan Singer is up to his old Days of Future Past tricks again. Brett Ratner was in town to talk Hercules, which is a movie that has nothing to do with Belgian detectives and everything to do with The Rock and a massive club. So please do very much enjoy this interview.
We're delighted to be joined in the pod booth by Brett Ratner, director of Hercules, among many other films. Hello, sir. How are you?
Great to be here.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. Where are you with the film now? You've just told us you've been up all night.
Oh, my God. I'm in the last hours of locking everything. It is actually an epic film, to say the least, not only because of the story, but because of the amount of work and effort that has taken to kind of launch this baby. And it's really because I've never had a movie released on IMAX, so, or 3D. Okay. So I'm really doing three versions of the movie. Usually I do a 2D version and I walk away and the movie comes out and it's all nice. I have to approve because there's an incredible, complicated technical process.
Yeah.
Of taking a film from 2D to 3D, okay? Depth, as you know, and you know all the technicalities. And so it's like as if I'm doing three versions of the movie, you know? And so usually shots come in, visual effects shots, changes. But now you have to drop it into three different formats, and it is unbelievable. The workflow, I mean, I think I'm going to make it to the premiere, but then afterwards I'm going to probably check into a I've eaten more sugar than any, because I don't drink or do any kind of drugs or anything, so sugar is my drug. So to stay awake all these hours, I've literally gained 20 pounds being here in London finishing the movie.
What do you think of London sweets? Have you discovered anything new? Because in my personal opinion, British chocolate is better than American chocolate. I'm going to float that out there.
I think I've had my favorite chocolate so far. I haven't really gotten to. I mean, I've eaten all the chocolate that's been put into my room. So, but otherwise, Belgian chocolate is my favorite. But okay. I think London's got a. I heard from some of my friends that are much bigger than me. But I'm on my way to being the size of Orson Welles if I don't leave here.
It's I saw some of the footage yesterday. There's an amazing battle sequence.
Yeah.
Which seems to be largely done for real.
That was kind of my approach, because the story is really a grounded story. I mean, it deals with the myths, but it's really the realistic, say, version of this tale. I didn't mind visual effects, but John Bruno is my visual effects supervisor. He's done a few films with me. He's really Jim Cameron's guy. He's done Avatar and most of Jim's movies. I think he won the Oscar for The Abyss. He's more about practicality as far as building the sets and then using visual effects as extensions. Mm. So these are probably the biggest sets I will ever have on any movie ever. Not where the battle was, because that was like a little village, that you saw, but unbelievable builds. And because we were in Budapest, we were able to afford building these monstrous. You felt like you were on the set of the Bible or something, or like, I mean, it was walking around was, and it killed me when I left and they started taking down the sets. I'm like, what are they, crazy? This could be like an amusement park for tourists. Yeah. But so it was spectacular just being there physically, instead of being in a room that's green screen and then of course they digitally, which is kind of, I think, the way 300 was done, very small kind of foreground elements. But here the actors and the crew and we're actually there on set in with these walls around us in this world where you feel like you're in 358 BC, and it transports you there. It's amazing.
Which came first for you, though, Hercules or The Rock?
Actually, Hercules. I'd been toying with a few kind of films in the genre, God of War. Mm. At one point, I was offered Conan, and actually was offered, several movies in the genre. I'd always kind of had an interest in this genre, and I thought that, in the past, a lot of these great filmmakers have done their kind of epic kind of sword and sandal kind of films. I said, I got to do it at least once. So I've been toying with it a while, started developing it. And then I get a call that Dwayne Johnson wanted to see me. I said, of course, God. And thinking, and really not thinking about, like, okay, who's the perfect guy for this? Because I was so deep in kind of getting the story right. And it's because I fell in love with the graphic novel, because it was the first one I read that wasn't set. It was demystifying the myth, and it wasn't just all myth, and which is a lot of, you know, Clash and all these other films are kind of in that world, and I didn't want to do just that. I wanted to kind of do a grounded version, going back to Spartacus, or, you know, the films I kind of grew up loving and watching. And Dwayne walked into my house, sat down, looked me in the eye, and said, "I was born to play this part." And when he says it, you believe it. Not only because of his muscles, but he looks at you, and I remember the moment that I saw, and literally, as I watch the movie, I don't see Dwayne Johnson. I mean, I don't know if you do, but I'm looking and going, it's not Dwayne Johnson. Dwayne Johnson has a bald head. He's always wearing a tank top, you know, and like doesn't have a mustache or beard. He's always clean, you know. We were in London for a fitting for his hair and his wardrobe. I literally saw him looking in the mirror. I caught him sitting there as they placed the beard on him and as the fit the wig. And I literally saw a transition. I said, this is our modern day Hercules. I literally got chills. I'm getting chills now thinking about it. I watched the transformation before my eyes. Usually, you know, he shows up on set and he's the guy. I watched him look at himself in the mirror, and I actually took a picture at that moment. Not in the moment that transformation happened, but as he was looking at himself.
Because he did crazy amounts of training. And
oh, God. He was like, Brent, if you mess up this one, I'm going to kill you. I mean, because he was waking up at 2, 3 in the morning and eating, like, I'm exaggerating, but, like, you know, how many meals a day? 6, 8 meals a day, you know? It was a lot of work.
That sounds like my heaven, but then in between all the eating, he has to do the working out.
He has to work out,
I think those were 8 meals of pure chicken. It's not 8 meals of, like,
protein.
Crisps.
Yeah.
Well, if it's Nando's, then we can talk. Or KFC. Then we can absolutely have that conversation. If I'm available for sequels, by the way.
Perfect.
If Dwayne drops out for whatever reason, I can pop up, man. I can do it. But this is a character that has been difficult to nail. How difficult is it to get Hercules right?
He's a mercenary. He uses his team and his nephew to kind of spread the legend, so he doesn't actually have to fight as hard, right? It's like, tell him what a badass I am, then we go in there and then they'll run, right?
So he's a pioneer publicist.
Exactly. So we don't have to fight, you know, as hard. And they still have to fight, they still have some battles, but at the end of the day, he finds that inner strength and that inner belief and that belief in a higher power, which brings him to the Hercules that they've been spreading the myth about. So it's a great story, and it's a story that I discovered in the graphic novel, and I'm very proud of the film. And I think Dwayne is not only a great person, but he's a guy who embraces a character, you know, 200%, and brings vulnerability and strength and everything that you want in a superhero. You know, the Hercules is truly the first superhero.
You did, I believe, a comic of Hercules versus Superman when you were a kid.
I did, yeah.
And it sort of came to a tie, I believe you said.
I was going through all my old stuff, because I used to draw comics when I was a kid, and Superman was my thing, and Batman, actually. And I didn't remember. I just knew, you know, that I'd drawn a bunch of them, and I started looking through them, and I found a Superman versus Hercules, which was crazy. And I was away when we were doing this book, so I wasn't able to kind of implement it into this book on the making of Hercules. But one day I'm going to pull it out. It's like, it's hysterical. I mean, because it's like little kid drawings, which are really fun.
What about the sort of the fighting in the movie? Were you trying to kind of, you know, create a slightly different, slightly new fighting style? Because it's tough,
you know. I mean, he's got this big club, and, you know, he's bashing people in the head with it. And, you know, I call it the Jackie Chan kind of violence, because it's, you know, it is a PG-13 movie, but it feels like a hard R. The only difference is you don't see blood. It's really, but it's very intense. And I mean, you saw that battle scene, right?
Yeah.
It could be, not that, you know, to pat myself on the back, but it could be a battle scene in a Gladiator, or, you know, except that you're not seeing heads being severed.
If you had blood in that sequence,
if you saw blood. And I really looked at, you know, a 300 or whatever, and every shot in 300 has blood splattering.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, how can I make this hardcore, edgy, violent? Because violence isn't necessarily about blood. It's about the intensity behind the violence the anger or the passion behind the violence that it will. So I wanted to go for something that was very violent. So it's what I say, Jackie Chan's violence is also, and especially in Rush Hour films, is very real. You know, we pull guns, we shoot people, but you don't see the blood ever.
Yeah.
But I learned from that. I said, wow, it could be kind of moments of kind of, you know, edginess and danger without having the actual seeing the blood fly.
It's so weird that a rating often comes down to that. You know, just how much blood
and
is
how
there.
Many times you say the F word, actually.
Yes. It's so crazy.
You know, if you have one F word in the movie, you know, you get away with it. So
it's crazy. I mean, it really, the only time in your career you've even embraced that sort of level of violence and horror is Red Dragon. And I guess that's a
But even that movie, if you look at, I really kind of, even though Jonathan Demme's advice was don't watch my movie, don't watch Hannibal, just do your own version, don't think about it. But I really looked at it and I thought what Jonathan did brilliantly and why I thought that was the best film in the series was that he scared people by what you didn't see rather than what you did see. Mm. Ridley chose to kind of do the horror version of the story and show you, you know, show the character eating the brains out of his head, which I think turned off a lot of people. But it was a brilliant film, but it was just very graphic. And I said, I'm going to go back to kind of more in the direction of what Jonathan Demme did in where he scared people rather than what they didn't see, and using sounds and using, you know, lighting and a lot of that stuff. So that was something that I was very proud of, because I think it was a very, very scary movie. I remember sitting in the theater, and I'd never done a horror movie or, you know, a thriller like that before, psychological thriller. Mm. But I wanted to scare people, again, psychologically rather than visually. And I loved having people sitting in that theater with an audience and watching people, like, literally. It's funny. I'll never forget one time I was sitting in the theater with Anthony Hopkins, and we were in the back, and I was looking forward, and there was this one moment, I forgot what it was, that there was a terrifying moment, and half the audience were holding their eyes and half the audience were covering their ears. It's an incredible lesson, really.
Yeah. You just need a few more with their hands and their mouth.
But it was like, if they can't hear it, they won't be scared.
Yeah.
So sound is such an important, powerful element. It really is. And I'm always sensitive to that when I spend the most time probably mixing the movie. Any movie, even if it's not a scary movie like that, but just getting, you know, making sure every sound that I want to achieve, whether it's a sword hit or I really spend a lot of time doing it. I think the best filmmaker in the world at that is Oliver Stone. I think his sound design is just masterful. When I went to see the Twin Tower movie he did,
World Trade Center.
Yeah. When I went to see that, I said, how is he going to do the sound of these buildings falling? I mean, how is he going to, I was so fascinated to see how he was going to accomplish it. And he did such a brilliant thing. By the way, it was earth-shattering when these buildings fell. Mm. But then what you would expect if you were in any really close vicinity of that, that you would go deaf almost. It would be so loud that it would just become like a hum. And it was such a brilliant piece of design work when that, if you go watch that movie again, that tower falls, and I would say watch it in 7.1 because it is just mind-blowing. But almost the silence is deafening, and you felt like your ears were clogged up.
It's extraordinary. I think you must have the most packed Rolodex. Not that anyone has a Rolodex these days, of other directors in Hollywood. You seem to be an incredibly well connected person. You know, you're talking to Oliver Stone, your friends Roman Polanski, Steven Spielberg. Yeah. How do you break the ice with these guys? Because is there ever a moment when you're still talking to, say, Steven Spielberg, and a little part of you goes, "This is Steven Spielberg."
Yeah, always. I was just 2 nights ago meeting the Prime Minister of England, and they invited all of Hollywood there, basically. So all the studio heads were there. And, you know, there was a lot of cool people in the room. But all I wanted to talk to was every single director in the room. Tom Hooper and you know, I mean, literally, I just went from director to director just to, you know, some I pinched their butts, some I, you know, shook their hands and gave them a hug. And I was just like, there could be a room of the coolest people in the world, but if there's a director in the room, I just want to be in conversation with that director. I don't care, you know. And I'm just fascinated with filmmakers, and I'm just a huge fan. So I think they sense that, my passion for their work. And, you know, it's nice to hear, you know, it's nice to, and I love hearing their stories and picking their brain. You have to understand, when I went to film school, you know, the only director I met was Robert Wise, and he was like 100 years old at the time, you know. And I was like, I was the kid in the class that kept, you know, one more question. I'm like, okay, you know, like, okay, everyone, I had like 50 questions for him. They're like, Brett, can you have, let someone else ask a question, you know. And now, you know, I go to film schools and speak, and there's a lot of integration with Hollywood and filmmakers and film students, really.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, I was at NYU, which is the best school in the world. And then 4 years, I saw one director. They screened West Side Story, and then the guy came in and spoke to us, and he was like in a wheelchair, basically. But it was, but so yeah. So I'm a big fan of movie directors, and I do have to pinch myself when I'm in Paris with Roman Polanski, and actually now my company is financing his new movie. So wow. So it's exciting. It's exciting for me. And that's why it was inevitable that I was going to have a company that was going to be financing movies, aside from me being a director, because I'm just such a big fan of filmmakers, and just to somehow even paying for a kind of an affiliation. I mean, I'm financing Alejandro Iñárritu's new movie, The Revenant, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hardy. And Alejandro's just been my friend, you know, for years. It's just a great guy. But just the fact that I got, you know, the first draft of the script, I'm reading it. I mean, it's so exciting for me. And I'm just like a cheerleader. It's not like I want to go in there and say, hey, Alejandro, I didn't like that scene that you did. I'm like the best person to produce or executive produce your movie, because I'm just so happy for you and excited for you. And I don't want to hang out on the set. I got my own, you know, I don't want to be there like looking over your shoulder. I'm just happy to be, I'm like the best cheerleader ever.
So you don't give difficult notes
then? No, I mean, I think if I watch the movie and I have an opinion, I'll give it to them. But I know what it is to make a film. I know how difficult it is. I know what the process should be. So I'm not there acting. I have my own movies that I have to stress about and worry about.
I wanted to ask you about Days of Future Past. Have you seen it yet?
Oh, the X-Men?
The X-Men, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it.
I was just wondering, because, you know, was there a moment where you wanted to kind of call Brian up afterwards and like, you bastard, you've written my story out of existence. But I guess he's written his own out of existence at the same time.
That's a complicated that's a complicated thing, because I think Brian, I think probably regrets not doing the third, you know, and I regret not doing Superman, so we're even. I don't think it was a purposeful thing. Interestingly enough, you know, and I get it, you know, there's rabid fans for all these characters, you know. And when you kill them off, there's some anger involved. Mm. Of course, I'm the director, I get the blame. But unfortunately, I came on the movie, I don't know if you remember, there was another director.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I came on the movie 8 weeks before. That script was locked. It was a $235 million movie. There was, I mean, yeah, I was making dialogue changes. But, you know, the one rule that I asked Zach and Simon Kinberg was, make sure that anything that happens in this movie, okay, has happened or existed in a comic book. And I literally made them pull the frames. Because I don't know that, you know, I wasn't growing up reading those comics.
Right?
I knew the cartoon. And so I said, guys, there has to be a real reference to this. So when the fans come, because what Brian's great advice to me was before we start shooting, do not, whatever you do, do not go on the internet and read what they're writing. They wrote the exact same thing about me.
Good advice.
When I was doing the first X-Men, do not read it, because they're going to convince you. They're going to sway you. They're going to say everything. They're going to make you doubt, question yourself. Just dive in and go do it. So I did that. I had Simon Kinberg, the expert, and Zach Penn, who wrote those scenes, wrote the killing of all these characters. And I'm the one getting the blame.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not that I don't have authorship in the movie. I directed the movie, but I directed the movie that was a lot of politics involved in the X-Men universe. And Marvel was right there. Kevin Feige was right there by my side every day with Avi Arad, you know, watching me film these scenes. And, you know, it gave me a few notes when I finished the movie. I did their notes. The only note I didn't do of theirs, or it was really Avi's note, was Rogue.
Rogue.
Yeah. And there was a whole controversy over that and whatever. But otherwise, I shot the script. It's Simon Kinberg. So if anything, I want the fans to go find where Simon Kinberg lives and Zach Penn and leave me alone. And please talk to them about it. Well, they were on the movie a year before I came on the movie.
Simon was in the same chair you were in a couple of months ago, and he went, "Yes, it was. I killed Cyclops. I killed Professor X. It was me.
It was.
Yeah, it was, yeah. So
yeah, he did put his hands up. Yeah.
I read a few things where I kind of a few people pointed out some things that he said that kind of were. I guess he was getting some real death threats or something.
I think he might have been. Interestingly, I spoke to Brian quite a lot for our X-Men feature, Helen.
Yeah, amazing, by the way.
And he's told me an incredible story that when he was in, he was working on Superman Returns, that someone who should remain nameless, he didn't tell me who it was, sneaked him into a post-production facility at 3 a.m. to watch a rough version of Last Stand.
Really?
And you didn't know about this. He didn't tell
you.
Wow. So is this the first time you've heard this?
And, he didn't tell me, no.
Because he wanted to see what you were doing and he was attached to the character. He'd heard there were things happening and he wanted to make sure.
Well, I think I'm fine with that. Brian's a great friend.
Yeah.
Brian's a great friend. If he would have called me, I would have showed him the movie. You know, he probably thought I was sensitive or insecure about it. But I spoke to him a few times about it and I think I know who that was, actually, now that I'm thinking about it.
Oh, God. I've just outed someone.
he gave me great advice. He said, you should try to do everything they didn't let me do in the past because of budget.
Yeah.
So I did a Danger Room.
Yes.
Yep.
I went and did a Danger Room.
For a Sentinel. That was awesome.
I shot a Sentinel. I kind of did things that he wasn't able to do. Mm-hmm. Obviously, now on the new one, he kind of went all the way and... with the success of the series, and he got everything he wanted going forward, but I'm very proud of the movie. I love it. It's very different than Brian's movies are about an hour longer than mine, and they're you know, I would say, I don't know, say do they have more depth? Probably, but you know, it's I can tell you this: I would have never, if I would have done the first X-Men, I could have never done the job Brian did.
Okay.
Brian owns that franchise, and it would have killed me to have walked away from Rush Hour 3. The thought of letting some other director, I would have probably done what he did. I would have probably come back for a Rush Hour 4.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand it. How can someone walk away from their own franchise? It's a very difficult, it's your baby. Those actors are your family. I came on, I felt like, you know, I was an outsider, and they were accepting me into the family, but it was Brian's movie, and I really looked at the first two movies and thought, you know what, I got to make it my own. I'm a different filmmaker than Brian, you know. Brian, but his approach, and I think what it was the tone.
Mm.
I love the way he started the first movie with the Holocaust stuff and the you know, and just tone wise, he nailed it, and I felt his presence or his directing kind of style on this. One day when I was shooting Magneto, and most of the scenes in X-Men are interiors.
Yeah.
Most of them.
Yeah.
We're on a street in a neighborhood, and there's a bunch of kids on bicycles. And we had a shot, and we were rehearsing, and Magneto is walking down the street in a cape with his costume and a helmet. And I'm going, and he's dead serious, and he believed every... And I'm like... If you just look at it, you're like, this is like a comedy. What is going on here? But you have Ian McKellen, one of the great theater actors on Earth, one of the great actors in the world. Nobody could have been more serious at that moment.
Yeah.
Mm.
Just in a walk. Remember that house that he...
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
I was like, Jesus Christ. So Brian set that seriousness and that tone. And I'm grateful to him because I'm happy to have been part of it. You know, of course it's the most, you know, if someone else directed a Rush Hour, they'd be the victim of all the fanboys who were like, Brett Ratner's Rush Hour. There's a different kind of fan for that because they didn't grow up reading Rush Hour comics. But people, you know, when someone has 20 years of their life, you know, living with these characters, I get it. There's an emotional, and that's why I don't go on and respond to them and like, hey, you know, I'm telling you it's Simon Kinberg's fault. But the truth is, I'm proud of the movie.
Yeah.
I would not change one frame if you asked me to go back and change a frame. And I think with time, you know, it'll come around. And I think Brian's been very gracious about it and when asked about it and stuff. Brian's a great guy. I love Brian. Very talented. And I'm a huge fan of his.
Brett Ratner, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir.
Great talking to you guys. All right.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks.
Movie reviews time now, and in an unbelievable turn of events, some new ones have been released just this week, which leads me to think that we ought to talk about them. As we just heard from its director, let's dropkick things off with Hercules, a film that has his rockness rocking a lion hat in ancient Greece, beating up baddos and feeling a little bit tortured about things that happened in his past. I'm going to review this one because I am the person who saw it. It's a very simple setup. Nominally, The Rock is Hercules. He is the son of Zeus and a normal mortal woman. He is incredibly big. He has muscles coming out of his muscles, and he can punch things through walls and through doors and through anything you can possibly think of. He's Hercules, right? He has 12 labors. He's done 11 of them at this point, which is pretty good going. Well done, Hercules. He's killed the Hydra and its many heads. He has killed the massive boar. And you've seen it in the trailer, I'm sure, where he runs up a tree with his massive club in hand and just twonks it in the head. He's at that point. But it turns out, in a very neat twist, what they've done here is made this a world where this myth is just that. It's a myth. Whether he is actually the son of Zeus is not made clear. Kind of is, it kind of isn't. He isn't the son of Zeus because gods, you know, they don't actually exist. But everyone thinks he is the son of Zeus. He has a group of friends that help him. They're filled out by a really, actually, really enjoyable group of characters. We're a big fan, aren't we, Phil, of Rufus Sewell?
Big fan.
He plays a knife-throwing, kind of slightly weaselly, imagine that. He's, you know, number two. You have got Ian McShane, the legend that is Ian McShane, a man whose voice makes women tremble. He is an extraordinary human being. I love him to pieces. And he plays a seer who can, quote-unquote, see into the future. But they even play around with that idea as well. You know, is this person actually seeing into the future or possibly lucky or possibly something else? Anyway, there are a few others. There's an Amazonian archery specialist. Let's call her an archer. And there is a Viking-style barbarian who just runs at people, and they're his gang. There's also the nephew of Hercules, who's played by Shane Ritchie. By Shane Ritchie? Imagine that. Who's played by Reese Ritchie, though Shane Ritchie would have really nailed the role, despite the fact that the, you know, age difference would have been awful. And they're his gang. Dan Jolin, who reviewed the film and watched it with me, called them the Mythnificent Seven, even though there are, in fact, six of them. Anyway, so they're that group, and they go around the country essentially being mercenaries. They go around ancient Greece getting things done, earning money. They are then asked by the ruler of Thrace to help him with his problem. There are rebels in his land, and he needs Hercules, the great Hercules, to train his, not really an army, but just a group of farmers with some shields to go and vanquish them. That's where we are. But as I mentioned, there is this mythological fun that they're having. When you see the slightly ropey CG, you're going, is this actually what's happening? Or is it just, you know, what is it? It's actually quite well done. It also boasts one of the best 12A F-bombs that I have ever enjoyed. And I'm a big fan of them. Obviously, the one in X-Men First Class is possibly the best ever. But this one rivals it. I will tell you just the sequence. And I think this says a lot about what this film does. It's very solid. It has the ropey lines occasionally that you're expecting. It's a little bit, you know, on the nose. There is a bit where Reese Ritchie is telling the tale of Hercules and said, I promise you this is true. Hercules is the son of Zeus. That's right, the Zeus. Anyway, so there's a battle sequence. There are three really big battle sequences. And in the second one, guy's charging at The Rock, at Hercules, on his horse. He's really coming down at him. Then The Rock lifts the horse up from under its belly and just tosses it in the air. The horse and its rider smash into the ground, and he says the words, fucking centaurs. Amazing. Straight to camera. Just fast five levels of surreal rockiness. Action, totally good, basic, entertaining, fun. Not that inventive, not that anything, but really solid. And I think that's my general feeling for the whole film. I walked in not expecting a lot from this movie, but it actually delivers entertainment on a very reliable level. It's not maybe as funny as I'd like. It's not maybe as, you know, deep as you might want from, say, a Ridley Scott type take on this sort of thing, but compare it to Pompeii earlier in this year, which was quite bad. That was funny because it didn't get what it was doing right. You were laughing at how kind of incompetent, perhaps. That's a little unfair. It was. This, however, is entirely competent and just gets the job done and has a little bit more on its bones than you might have given it credit for. In short, 3 stars is a recommendation, and this does get 3 stars. I would never in a million years consider giving this 4, let's put it that way. But at the same time, if you're looking for this sort of riotous, rocky romp, it's been a while since The Rock's been in one of these movies. Fast 6 was a bit of a disappointment. Fast 5 was a long time ago. And, you know, Faster and that lot aren't that much cop. So I would give this a thumb up rather than 2 thumbs up. 3 stars for Hercules, and That is not us sitting on the fence. I actually totally back that up.
One of the big questions this week is Nicolas Cage is back on our screens, and is he any good in David Gordon Green's Joe?
All the posters seem to be four stars everywhere, lots of love.
And I'm saying that he is really, really good. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie, I have to say. David Gordon Green's just, to me, a really fascinating filmmaker. If you saw Prince Avalanche, his last film last year, and I recommend that as well. It's one of those films that kind of you couldn't put your finger on exactly why, but it really creeps under your skin and leaves a mark on you. Terrence Malick is clearly a filmmaker that he's very much enthralled to. Even, you know, old sort of Fassbinder and Werner Herzog and those sorts of people. But at the same time, he made The Sitter and Pineapple Express. And go figure. We could spend all day trying to figure that out. One in the eye for anyone who believes that you have to be an auteur and you have to have one unique vision, because he can do so many different things. And this is, I think, one of his very best. It's got Nicolas Cage playing this guy Joe, the title character. He's an ex-con. He works out in the boondocks of the Deep South, and he poisons trees basically for a living. He takes a gang of guys who probably otherwise be out on their own with no work into woods, kills the trees to replace them with saplings. So there's a sort of a metaphor there of this idea of kind of renaissance and out with the old, in with the new, which reflects in his relationship with Ty Sheridan's character. He's a 15-year-old who has a brutally alcoholic, violent, abusive father, played by his character called Gary Poulter, who I'll just talk about in a minute. But Ty Sheridan, again, you'll know from Mud, a film this has one or two things in common with, and Tree of Life again. And it's beautiful. There's moments of sort of Malickian transcendence in the way that it's shot, the way that it's paced, and there's explosive Nick Cage moments. There's an extraordinary sequence with a dog, which I won't even begin to spoil. He's so good in this film. It shows you what he can do when he reins back. You know, I think we enjoy him when he's doing the bees and he's doing the craziness, but he's kind of played that. That's a bit played out, and it's just nice to see him reining about, playing a really understated, just showing how good an actor he really is. And it's, but yeah, he takes this young kid under his wing, and it's a sort of a, it's a kind of a, he's a father figure, and his real father is a violent lunatic, and the tension kind of builds from that. There's elements of thriller in it, but it's not really a thriller. It's very much a character drama, languidly paced, sometimes explosive, times emotional, and it's all underpinned by really a sterling performance by Nick Cage, and I thoroughly recommend it. We've given it four stars.
How distracting is his beard? Because on the poster, it's a different colour to his hair, and it's frankly freaking me out.
Yeah, it's distracting, but Nick Cage is distracting for the first 5 minutes of any film I think he's in, isn't he? Because you're getting over all the baggage he brings with you. You're expecting him to go Ghost Rider, and he doesn't.
Do you think it's a real beard as well? Because
it's hard to say.
There's a fake. His
it had to be planted onto him every day.
Wow,
pretty impressive. Apparently, but it was made with yak hair.
In the Neo-Shamanic Acting Handbook, and there is such a thing. It's about 65 pages long and illustrated. You would always grow your own facial hair, but then you could dye it or
eat it,
or take it out into the woods with a witch doctor and
shoot it,
dance around. Who knows?
I was wondering about the story that he told on the Nick Cage special, which came out this time last year, where he said during Joe he stared down a snake.
There's an amazing snake scene in this, and yes, it involves what looks like a fairly venomous, not poisonous, of course, serpent of some description, which the two of them had some kind of shamanic communion on set, no doubt.
I really want to see him in Prometheus 2 when they face off against one of those evil snakes. I would love to see Nick Cage in Prometheus 2. I
think Cage wouldn't make that mistake. He knows what he's doing with snakes. He knows what he's doing with everything. He's really good in the woods. He's good in... Look, this seems like a really rich period for this kind of neglected milieu of, you know, film settings. The Deep South and True Detective.
Southern Gothic.
True Detective has totally nailed it. You know, there's elements of that here as well. Mud, Killer Joe, William Friedkin's film, Winter's Bone a few years back, Beast of the Southern Wild. They're all different films, but they're all set in this, you know, and you have these kind of characters who are that close to sort of to having nothing to live for. It just ramps up the sense of sort of jeopardy and the sense of the fact that they're close to the edge a lot. And you see that in this film. So I don't want to go on much longer, but I mentioned him earlier, Gary Poulter. He's one of the fascinating stories of the year. This guy, this is his only film performance. He plays Ty Sheridan's alcoholic father, and it is an incredibly authentic performance, not least because he actually is an alcoholic, and he died during filming, not in mysterious circumstances, but he was you know, this is the world he comes from. I'm not, he's not like his character in any way, but David Gordon Green was under pressure to maybe cut him loose because he was incredibly difficult, I think, to work with, understandably. And he didn't, he persisted, and he was rewarded with his one and only movie performance, and is one of the performances of the year, I would say. He doesn't share a lot of screen time with Nicolas Cage, but the two of them together and Ty Sheridan are both, or all three of them, really, really remarkable in this film.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. It sounds like a movie that's worth seeing in the cinema. So, you know, if you're curious about going to see this, it's probably going to be one of those limited release local cinemas that are into this sort of thing type jobs.
But yeah, or you could get it on an old VHS probably as well, if you wanted to, from a schoolmate.
What? Yeah. No, don't. Please, don't do that. VHSs are bad.
No, that doesn't make any sense because it's on demand right now.
So we could go and just like watch it right now.
You could right now watch this film.
Yeah, I've got a lot of
But continue to listen to the podcast and then listen and then watch it.
Okay, great. Joe, four stars. Wonderful. I am excited to see that film. Right, now let's move on to The Purge Anarchy, which takes the world of The Purge, where once a year the world is allowed to do whatever the bloody hell it wants, which essentially boils down to killing people. We call it Press Day in the Empire office, and removes it from the homely environs of Ethan Hawke and co, and instead brings it outside, where Frank Grillo is, and murders can be made more spectacular, and people can run further without hitting walls. Phil, is this film a good film?
It's okay, yeah. I watched Purge Anarchy first, and then I watched The Purge. So to my mind, this franchise is getting smaller. But I guess if you watch it the normal way, you'd see an expansion of the world. And an expansion of the budget. We talked about this in the interview, but Jason Blum's model is, I think, $5 million maximum budget, 23, 24 days shooting in LA. This film conforms to those two, but perhaps not the first. It's a more expensive Blumhouse production than we've seen before. And that's reflected on the screen. It's a bigger, more ambitious kind of piece. And it's, if you like a lot of chocolate on your biscuit, join Frank Grillo's club.
Good.
Get Hercules's club. Frank Grillo's club involves Frank Grillo is the heart of this movie, the beating heart and pulsing bicep of this movie. He's the tough guy. He is the man who is out there on Purge night because what the hell? He's not a bad guy, but he's got some past. And he's out there and he's doing some, you see him at the beginning, he's tooling up. I'm so middle class, I can't even say the word tooling up properly. He's tooling up.
The boy is putting all his tools in his bag and tooling up. Off to work.
He's tooling up, he's strapping a scone to his arm. he's got everything you could need for a good day's violence.
He's
cricket bat.
Raspberry fooling up.
He's tooling up at the beginning of this movie, and he's going out. You don't know why, but you suspect there's a revenge mission. He's taking advantage of this one night of lawlessness to go out there and exact terrible revenge. But along the way, he stumbles across a motley crew of people who, for different reasons, are stuck outside or are exposed to violence and are really out of their depth. And he's left with this choice of whether to leave them to their deaths or to help them get through or at least get to safety. And there's a pact made, and obviously it doesn't involve him leaving to their deaths because that would be a short and terrible film. So that's what happens from then on. There's horror elements. There's this gang of masked guys that you meet early on that keep popping up and you wonder what their agenda is. There's some great kind of cityscape shots, deserted. Everyone's obviously indoors now. The klaxon keeps sounding. There's these announcements of when, you know, Purge night starts and how long it's going to last for and who's dying, and it tracks it on the media using news feeds, and there's a suspicion that there's maybe a bigger conspiracy at work. There's these big trucks driving around Los Angeles just killing people indiscriminately. It's a kind of a brutal sort of satire, I guess, a little bit like John Carpenter might have done with They Live. It's that sort of thing. It's you know, it gets into assaulting the values of the super wealthy, but it's not really interested in just being a plain satire. It's more of a thriller with horror elements. And if you like those sorts of movies, if you like early John Carpenter, early Walter Hill, Warriors, Escape from New York, those sorts of films, there's a lot to like in this one. It's got all of that in spades, and it's got Frank Grillo, who is an actor who I think we're going to see more and more of, obviously from Captain America 2 and Warrior and a number of other films. He's got great charisma on screen, very sort of quiet.
He was Crossbones, I believe, in Captain America 2.
That's correct.
And he was really enjoyable. He's such a, I mean, He's in his 50s, isn't he?
He's actually 49.
He's 49?
No, he's 49.
But he looks like he's 20.
I actually interviewed him about this movie, and he told me that he puts it down to good living. He eats well. He says he drinks not to excess, but he likes wine and tequila occasionally. I can see him drinking tequila without it having any effect on him whatsoever.
Mm.
And he has the occasional pizza because he's from Italian stock, so that would be right. But he's not a stressed dude. He says he just doesn't get stressed about stuff, and then he kind of conveys that on screen. He's got that kind of brooding Clint Eastwood, Snake Plissken kind of. He's in control, in an out of control, anarchic, a manarchic, if you prefer, environment. And he's the tent pole in this movie. He's sort of there with him. Everyone's with him. We're going with him, and he's gonna see us through. There's gonna be some nastiness along the way. And, as I say, if those movies, those touch points...
Ring
your bell, I would have a look at this film. We've given it 3 stars. It's definitely a recommendation, but it's probably a specific recommendation for fans of Warriors, etc.
Okay, gotcha. I really hope his career turned into kind of a Jason Statham-y type thing, because I think he'd be great in a... You know, he would 27%, he would increase the value of a relatively generic action movie just by being in it, because I think he has that charm thing.
He does have that charm thing. I think he can do the funny stuff too, actually. And he's got just a bit of self-awareness. But yeah, I'd like to see a lot more of Frank Grillo, definitely.
Now, there are many other films. Well, not many, but there are a few other films that are also coming out this week. But what I'm going to do, instead of just listing them and giving you just the star ratings, I'm going to ask you to go onto EmpireOnline.com. And just look at them. They're all there. There are a variety of them. Go check them out. Just a few, Believe is one of them, The House of Magic, Eartha Kitt. They're all up there. Do check out the reviews. They have been written, and they are there for you to enjoy. So do check them out. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be talking to the likes of Chris Pratt, Andy Dwyer from Parks and Rec. Just the best guy ever. And also the Inbetweeners boys, who will no doubt be riotous and say rude words. Until then, it's goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to insert in joke here that you made during the podcast. I never understand what happens here when Chris... This hosting's harder than it looks. Look, I'm just going to say goodbye, and I really hope you come back next week. Until next time.